found out about it. And when she did, she was furious, as you can imagine. But she finally came in later years to accept that as just a part of the family lore, and she would be able to laugh about it herself later on. Now, Francis took a great shine to me because I was her little kid brother, and my mother was very active in church work, the ladies' aid, we called it. She was always involved in putting on church suppers, teaching Sunday school, singing in the choir, and, you know, just looking after her family was a big chore. And she, in that huge house, that was really something to keep up. Well, it fell to Francis then quite often to be my babysitter. We didn't call them that in those days. That was a term that came about many, many years later, but that's what she was. And Mother would ask Francis to take charge of me, and if she were going someplace on an errand or meeting some friends, she would take me along. And she didn't mind it at all. In fact, she liked it. She liked having her little kid brother along. Her friends were not above making some caustic remarks like, "Do you have to bring that kid with you all the time?" And she just smiled and let it go at that. Didn't bother her. Now, our family were quite musical early on. As I had said, Mother was always a member of the choir at First Methodist Church, very faithful member. And Frances started taking piano lessons when she was quite young and developed quite a good expertise on the piano. Then, as she grew older, up into her late teens and early 20s, she was approached about learning to play the church organ. The idea being that if she could learn to play the organ, she might become the church's organist. Well, she took to it, and she did become the church organist and was the church organist until she moved away in later years. This was after she was married and had children, and when she moved to Lockport. And of course, even when she moved to Lockport, she kept up her organ expertise and did church organ work up there as well. And after that, she purchased a Hammond-type organ. I'm not sure she ever had a Hammond, but she's had other brands like Wurlitzer and then in later years a Yamaha. And she was playing the organ right up to the days of her death, when she was just before 84 years old. Now, she had a fair amount of arthritis in her fingers, but that didn't stop her, and her health was not good at all in the last several years of her life, but that was her way of keeping up. And I must say that it was a wonderful thing to watch her. When she could hardly get around, she would manage to get up on the organ stool at home and play some of her old favorite pieces. And every time Emily and I would go to visit, we would ask her to play, and she would always accommodate us. And I just feel that Frances got so much pleasure out of it and gave so much pleasure to other people in her lifetime with her playing. And she was so faithful as the church organist in Salamanca. One other incident in the store, and this was after I had grown up a bit. We had a storage room down in the basement of the store where we put a lot of boxes, empty boxes and crates and things like that. Rather than throw them away, they would make pretty good firewood or furnace materials. We had a huge furnace which served the entire store as well as the three offices and the two apartments up in the second floor of our store building. And it was my job to go back there and kind of straighten the place up and restack the boxes and so on, make room for more. Well, I went back there one day and I heard this little cry, little mewing cry. Well, I recognized it as that of a kitten. Well, I started tearing that place apart. And sure enough, there was a litter of kittens. Some mother cat had gotten back in there and had her kittens, and there they were. Well, I went up and told my father, and I said, can I feed them, and can I take some home? And, oh, no, no, you can't do that. He said, what you do is you get a big paper bag, and you put them all that, and you take them over and drop them in the river. Well, I was horrified. I could no more do that. And I thought my father was such, I thought he was terrible to even suggest such a thing. But then, in later years, he did the job, by the way. I could bring myself to drown those little kittens. But I realized then that he had grown up on the farm. Well, they had cats all over the place, and they had so many around there, they had to get rid of them some way. They had to do away with them, and it became a routine thing for him. It wasn't like killing a person or killing a dog or anything like that. They were just little kittens that didn't even have their eyes open yet. Our next door neighbors were the Parkhills. Mrs. Parkhill and Guy Parkhill, the father who worked as a clerk for the BR&P Railroad. And Edwin was about 4 years older than I was, a year younger than George. We played together some, but after all, I was a little kid to these older fellows, George and Edwin. But Edwin had an accident. I think it was in the backyard. We were probably trying to pole vault. As I recall, we had set up a pole vaulting standard of sorts, and he had come down the wrong way and injured his hip, the upper joint of his thigh. Well, he seemed to get over that, but as time wore on, it became evident that he had sustained a permanent injury. Well, to make a long story short, he ended up going to Johns Hopkins, and he had developed osteomyelitis, I believe, from this injury. He had to have a very serious operation down there. Well, he ended up in a cast, and he was in that cast and out of school for about 6 months. Well, he became very bored with sitting around the house as an invalid, so I would go over and try to help keep him company and play games with him and so on. Well, we devised what I think was one of the first model airplanes ever made. We had never heard of one before, but he came up with the idea. This was a period when the Ford Trimotor was the first and popular passenger plane and cargo plane. It was made by the Ford Motor Company. It had three motors, and this would be in the 1920s, maybe 1920s, five or six, somewhere in there. So they, Parkhill family were all big smokers, and they always lit their cigarettes with the big wooden kitchen match, and they also lit their fires in the kitchen with them. They developed a lot of burned matches. Well, Edwin conceived the idea, and I went along with it, that we would make this trimotor airplane by gluing together all these wooden kitchen matches. Well, this became a major project, and it worked out. And we covered it for fabric. We covered it with red tissue paper that you would cover or wrap your Christmas presents in. Well, that was quite a project. In the plane, we had a wingspread of about 30 inches, and the body was about 18 or 20 inches long, and it was made pretty closely to scale. Also during that period, to help keep him company and occupied, I learned to play Mahjong. That was a very popular game in those days. It originated in China, and it was played with small tiles. Very exciting. And I even learned to play poker. But since then, I've never played poker since, and I can't even remember the rules of the game. One of my early playmates was Betty Gunn, and she was the daughter of the surgeon that I had mentioned earlier, who had repaired my finger. Betty was a year or two younger than I was, but we developed what we called an acrobatic act, in which we were doing tumbling and somersaults and handstands, headstands, and all that. Well, somebody in the neighborhood, I guess maybe it was Mrs. Parkhill, who was an avid member of the Masonic orders, said, you kids are good. We're going to get you to perform. So we were practiced up for it, and she arranged to have us perform. Somebody got an old mattress for us to tumble on, and we did our tumbling act at one of their big meetings over at the Masonic Order. We thought that we were hot stuff after that. We didn't get any other bids to go on the road or to join the circus from that, though. In 1922, there was a Holocaust in Salamanca, known, I guess, from ever after as the Big Fire of 1922. I was playing with the two Camar boys, George and Harry Camar, who lived farther up on Broad Street near town. And we were out, they had a big barn in the back of their house. And I guess in earlier days they'd had horses there, and it had all the trappings and stalls and everything that were needed. But we were playing around in back there when we heard the fire siren go out, signaling that there was a fire somewhere in the town. Well, as kids are, you know, you want to. This was in the summertime. We were not in school. A fire is an exciting thing, and you want to see what it's all about. Well, it happened that this fire was just a block and a half away. It started down in back of stores, which were right across the street from the Camires, and happened to also be in back of Dietrich Hardware Company. It was later determined that this fire had started probably from from spontaneous combustion, which occurs, as you probably know, from oily rags and combustible material like that, gathering heat until they get to the point of combustion and they just catch fire. Or it could have been somebody throwing a careless match after lighting a cigarette. Anyway, this fire started, and it took off. There was a lot of, it was down in the garage, and there was a lot of oil and combustible material around there. Well, we kids naturally ran down there to see what it was all about, and we saw the fire apparatus come, and they seemed to be getting it under control, but not quite. And it began to spread. Well, it, in hardly any time at all, it became a big fire, and they didn't have a whole lot of fire apparatus in our town. They had it all out there, but it wasn't doing the job. Well, obviously they needed extra help. And in a case like that, you call to other towns and ask them to come. Well, who makes that decision? In our case, it was the mayor. The mayor said, Henry McCann was his name, he said, we can do it, we don't need to call out. That would be embarrassing to have to call Olean or Bradford or Little Valley and send their equipment. We can do it, but they didn't. And the fire spread, and it spread, and before you knew it, it had caught in the whole business district, all up and down the Rhine. The river was a half a block to the north, where it couldn't jump over the river, but it went all the way down there, burned all the buildings except Brown's modern brick building. Brown had the Buick agency, which was right next to our hardware store. It burned both sides of the street, all the way back down to Broad Street, which was a long block. It started up both streets around the corner down there, Broad Street and Clinton Street, and burned, these were mostly wooden buildings, of course, and it just burned all those buildings up. And they finally had to get dynamite, and dynamite to provide a fire break in order to stop it. Well, it was, as they say, a holocaust. There was tremendous loss. In the case of Dietrich Hardware, it completely burned out. The building burned down. Burned up all of the inventory, just a total loss. It even burned up the safe. And my father happened to be out of town. He had gone with my mother to Cattaraugus to handle some matters of my grandmother's estate. She had died earlier that year, and being the oldest boy in the family, it was left to him to handle estate matters. So he was not there to contend with this, but Lester was next in charge, and he did the best he could. He happened to be home at lunch when the fire caught, and there was only a hired clerk there. Well, he panicked. He didn't know what to do, and he failed to call Lester. Well, by the time Lester got there and was aware that the fire had involved our store, things were out of control. So nothing was saved. We had a dynamite storage box down in back of the store. This was a big metal box in which we stored dynamite. It was always under lock and key. And whenever people needed dynamite, they would come in and buy it. And the caps and fuses were kept in a different place. Well, Lester perceived that this could be a huge hazard if the fire caught to this dynamite. It might explode, and there might be a tremendous explosion and greater damage than the fire. So he became a hero by personally opening up that box, and the fire is bearing down on the back of the store. It was going to reach there shortly. He personally carried all the dynamite in cases took his shoes off and waded out into the middle of the Allegheny River, which was only about 100 feet away, 150 feet, waded out into the middle of the river and deposited the dynamite out there so that it would not explode. So I guess if there was a hero of that occasion, it was Lester Dietrich. The store was, the building was not owned by my father. He just rented it. So he didn't have that loss, but he did have a huge loss on his inventory, the furniture and fixtures, the equipment in the shop, and so on. And it was a big blow. He had some insurance, but you know how it is. You never have enough insurance, 100% coverage. So he became a co-insurer for a very large amount of it. Well, he did not give up. There was the one store, as I had mentioned, or one building that escaped this was Brown's modern fireproof building right next door. So my father made a deal with him after the ashes had cooled and things were what to do. Various people decided they were not going to go back in the business. They gave up, but not my father. He decided to open his business up just as soon as possible, and he set up a temporary store up on the second floor of Brown's building. And opened up again, got merchandise in, and people were very good about it. They came and patronized him. He lost all his accounts receivable because they were burned. People would come around to him and say, "Herb, you know, I owed you some money there, and I think it's about so-and-so, and here's what I owe you." And he was very grateful for that because people could very easily say, "Well, here's where I get a free one." But they were very good and very honest about it and came by and paid him what they owed him. Not everybody, but most of them. So he decided then to get back in business in a very modern way, and he bought the property from the people that owned it. Just the lot now is all that was left after all the ashes and everything removed. I made a contract with Mr. Rice, Guy Rice, who was a general contractor, to build a brand new modern fireproof building. And that became known as the Dietrich Building. And as I had said before, had a basement where we had storage for merchandise as well as heavy goods that we couldn't store or display on the main store floor. And there was a shop down there, a sheet metal shop, to make furnace parts and so forth. And it had an elevator. And that was a lot of fun for me. It was a hand-operated. It was propelled only one floor from the ground floor where merchandise was received up to the main store floor. And I used to play around with that thing all the time, pulling myself up and down one story with this rope. It was on a series of pulleys. Well, my father got back in business. He had a fine store, one of the finest ones around. He had two apartments upstairs, three offices. He rented those. Everything looked good. And he had a big debt that went with it, however. But that did not seem to be a problem. However, in 1929, as everybody knows, the so-called Great Depression hit. And that made a big difference. Business slowed down to a walk. Nearly everybody wanted to buy on credit. They didn't have any money, so what could he do? He couldn't turn them down. So he ended up He and Lester. Lester was his junior partner. He ended up having a lot of money on the books that he just could not seem to collect. I remember going out with him many times on Saturday afternoons, trying to collect, and it would be the same story everywhere he went, especially out on the reservation where the Indians lived. They would say, "I haven't got any money, I can't pay you." They'd just shrug their shoulders and he'd go off empty-handed. Well, later on in my life, when I had my own business, I had similar experiences. And I could remember back and empathize with my father, the discouragement of that situation where business was bad. Even if business was bad, if you could do a cash business, as many businesses do today, you could still get along. But when you had to give out all that credit and people wouldn't pay you, it was just made an impossible situation. And it was a tough several years while the Depression was still holding fire. And really, it wasn't until the late 30s that things began to improve a little bit. And the banks were always pressing for payment. They were good about it. They could have foreclosed, but they didn't. And he just hung on by the skin of his teeth, but he did. A lot of people took bankruptcy. They just gave up, but not my father. He had some real pride, and not only that, but the energy and the desire to persevere over it all. Actually, the impact of the Depression on me personally was not that severe. My family always had enough to eat. In fact, we probably ate better, more nutritious meals because of having to watch the cost of them than many people do today. It was a common thing for my mother to come up to the store and say, rather apologetically, to my father, "Can you spare $3 so I can go grocery shopping over at Walworth and Stevens?" That was a grocery store across the street. And he would go to the till and dole out $3 $1 bills to her and put a slip in there. And she would go across the street and she would come back with, after doing very careful marketing, she would come back with a very substantial market basket. But that was basically the grocery outlay for a week, $3. I remember further that my father loved buttermilk. And we had refrigerators in the store. We sold them. Frigidaire was the product. And we always had one Frigidaire that was going, was operating. And when I would come in the store, say after school, he would say, "Here, take this little granite pail." It was a two-quart granite pail. "And go over to the dairy store," which was just down the street, "and get me 2 quarts of buttermilk." So I would take it down, and I don't know what it cost. It wasn't very much, less than $1 for 2 quarts, a lot less than $2, and then $1. And I would bring it back, and he would put it in the refrigerator, and that would be his snack time during the day. He would go in there and drink that cold buttermilk. And I thought to myself, I've heard so many stories about fathers who, in the old days, who used to send their kids to the corner pub bar to get them a pail of beer. But my father was pretty straight-laced. He was brought up in a very moral and very stringent household that looked down on things like drinking any kind of alcohol. So to him, it was very satisfying to drink buttermilk, which of course was good for him, as against drinking an alcoholic beverage. My father was a pretty strict disciplinarian in his dealing with me. For one thing, I was the last of the family at home. The rest, as we had grown up, had all gone away, married. Lester first, who married in 1923. Francis, who married Wilton Spear in 1932. And then George went off to college, and I was the one at home. Well, the pressures of the Depression, as I had mentioned before, were very great on him. And it seemed that he took a lot of that out on me. And my sister substantiated this some years ago when she said that Dad was very tough on you. And I realize why now. It wasn't that he was down on me particularly, but I guess I was available and I became the whipping boy to a certain extent. But looking back now and realizing, after having been in business myself and having known the pressures that are on a business person, and especially the tremendous pressure of the Depression on him in his business, I can understand why he might have lost his temper a bit with me, and goodness knows I deserved it, because I was pretty harum scarum in those days. One of the transgressions that was common for me was to go off and forget the time of day. I'd go off and play with old Don Carlskin or some of the others in the block. And finally, they would have to call up and say, would you please send Edward home? It's past dinner time. Well, I'd come home, the dinner was on the table, and my father would lay me out for being inconsiderate and late. And I would just stand there with my head down and take it, thinking, well, why does he have to pick on me? But he had grown up in an atmosphere, in his large family back on the farm, in which meals were always on time. They had to be on time because there were so many of them, and often they would have hired hands that they would feed right at the table with them up on the farm in Cattaraugus. So you didn't have four different meal times and people coming and going as they pleased at meals. So to him, it was important for people to be on time for meals. And as I have seen my family grow up, our family, and grandchildren as well, I can understand even more the importance of regular meal times and people showing up and sitting down, and more importantly, the family all eating together, not some wandering in and wandering out and disrupting the meal times. We had in our home what we called a vegetable cellar. This was down in the basement in a room beside the furnace room. And this vegetable room had an earthen floor, which kept it rather damp. And in that room were always a lot of vegetables, those that would still stand up over a period of a long time. You know, today we buy fresh vegetables, and if you don't eat them right away, or if they aren't refrigerated in the refrigerator, why, they go bad. But the vegetable room would allow certain vegetables, root vegetables, potatoes, for example, to last a whole lot longer And my mother always did a lot of canning in the summertime when vegetables and fruits were in. And we always had those wonderful cans of, always in glass jars, of peaches and pears and pickles and string beans and beets, just everything. Well, during the Depression, I thought, we must be pretty poor because we can't afford to buy canned goods, canned vegetables at the store. We have to eat vegetables and fruits that my mother can. Well, how I appreciate today those home canned foods, because they are so much better than canned foods and probably a whole lot better for you as well. I remember our first automobile that we had in the family. It was called an EMF. Well, that was the initials. Those were the initials of the manufacturer. I forget who his name was. I think it was the forerunner of the Studebaker. And the EMF, we used to kid and say it stood for Ever Mending and Fixing, because in those days, automobiles in the 19-teens and early 20s, automobiles were not as dependable as they are today. Especially that applied to tires. You couldn't go on a trip of any kind without having a blowout or two. Well, you didn't have a spare tire that was all ready to pop on as we have today. You had to take that wheel off, take the tire off, and get out the mending kit and patch the tire right there. Well, you know what that did to your timetable. You'd arrive sometimes an hour or so late because of the flats that you had to fix along the road. And when they finally developed a system of gas stations along the roads, service stations we call them, that was the big sign that they always had out in front. We fix flats, and believe me, they fixed plenty of them. My parents were both born in a town called Cattaraugus, which was about 16 miles away to the north. And their roots were very strong there, and their family ties as well. Their sisters and brothers still lived up there, the Dietrichs particularly. The Dietrichs all were farming people. And our common Sunday activities would involve a trip up to see the relatives up in Cattaraugus. Well, my father's family included Uncle Sam and Aunt Eva. They had two girls and a son. And right alongside of them lived Uncle Lewis and Aunt Mercy. The houses were very close together and very convenient to the barn, which was right across the road. Lived right alongside of them. And Uncle Lewis and Uncle Sam farmed together as partners. They had one son who was Howard Dietrich, and he lived until just a couple of years ago. And he moved to Florida and just died about 2 years ago over at Cape Coral on the West Coast. Then there was Aunt Eva, Dad's sister, and Uncle Louis Bernhoff. And they had two children. And then there was Aunt Anna, another sister who married Uncle Ernest Houghton. And they were all lived right together, with the exception of the two that lived out on the farm. They lived down in town. Uncle Ernest had a big feed mill in town in Cattaraugus. And he had a daughter and two sons. One of the sons is my only living cousin now, that is on the Dietrich side. That's Willard Houghton, and he still lives in the house that his parents lived in, there on Franklin Street in Cattaraugus. Every time I'm up that way, Western New York, Lester and I pile in the car and go up and have a good old visit with Willard Houghton. Those visits up there were, quite frankly, were kind of boring. And you have to remember, we didn't have a whole lot to entertain us back in those days, in the teens and the 20s. Radio was just starting, and it was very primitive. Television was many, many decades away from being perfected. So one of the most common pastimes was go visit your relatives. Well, they were always very cordial to us. And it was kind of interesting visiting the farm. We'd always go out in the apple orchard and pick apples when they're in season. And go down to the milk house and watch them milk the cows. They always had to do that every day. Cows cannot go one day without being milked. They have to be milked, and of course that was their livelihood too. They milked the cows, and then they had a cooling room. And the cool atmosphere in there was provided with ice, which they had cut during the winter and stored all through the summer. And it was amazing how ice would not melt and just melt away. They had this ice house, and they kept it packed in sawdust, and that allowed it to last through the hot summer period and allowed them to keep their milk cool. Their milk was put up in big 20-gallon cans, and each morning, very early in the morning, they would take it down to a little platform, which was alongside a local railroad spur that ran through there. And the so-called milk train would come through there every morning and pick up all these cans of milk that the farmers would bring out and put on their little platforms and take them into Buffalo, where they would be processed in creameries in the big city. My early days were very pleasant. And I guess it has been said in our family that being the last, the fourth, and youngest, that I got certain extra favors that the older children didn't. I don't know whether that's true or not. I thought of it as the other way around, but in retrospect, maybe it's so. Maybe I did get extra consideration. I know my parents loved me and showed their love for me, and this was very important not only to me then, but to look back and know that I was brought up in a family where the family ties were very strong and that family love was always present. Family support was there. My brothers and my sister certainly always supported me. Now, I have to admit that I had my problems with my brother George. George, you remember, was 5 years older than I was, and there was just enough age difference for George to think of me as the kid brother, which meant that sometimes I was a pain in the neck to him. But even with that, and with all the little battles that we used to have, and typical was the battle that we would have when George, who was tended to be very tall for his age, and accentuated by the 5 years difference, would pick on me once in a while. And he took great delight in what we call poking me with his index finger, poking me in the ribs. Well, that was enough to set me off. And I would start chasing him in the house, and up the stairs, up to the second floor, around the rooms up there, back down the stairs, around the house, I would go in hot pursuit. And he always managed to stay just out of arm's reach to me. So I got very frustrated, and I would let out whoops and hollers and cries that I was being picked on and so forth. And he was always challenging me to a boxing match. Well, my parents had bought boxing gloves for us at some point, I guess at Christmas. And George would say, come on, let's have a boxing match. Well, I thought, maybe I can get the best of him this time. So we'd put the gloves on. Well, George says, I'll give you an extra advantage. I'll box from my knees, and you can stand up, so you'll have an advantage over me. I said, okay. So then we would go at it. Well, what I hadn't realized, and it took me a lot of years to finally realize it, was that he had a much longer reach. His arms were much longer, and they were long enough so that he could just stand out there and fend me off, and I would go flailing at him and never land a blow on him. He always had me at arm's reach, and he would just get so tickled at me because I was so frustrated. Well, still in all, George was a great brother, and when we began to develop our musical talents and we were playing in the same organizations together, we always went off together, and he didn't leave me behind. He always said, come on, let's go, and we would go off, and we were considered a team, the Dietrichs, playing in whatever orchestra or band or whatever, and we played in just about everything. That brings up my musical career, which began when I was age 8. And I pestered my family, my mother and father, to buy me a saxophone. Saxophones were all the rage. I guess in that day was when Rudy Vallee was becoming quite popular, and of course he played the saxophone, and he was a great star and very much need to buy me a C Melody saxophone. Well, this was the recommendation of my first teacher, who was Ted Banton. Ted Banton was a first cousin of Florence, Lester's wife, and he had been a very successful musician. He had played with organizations all over the world, in orchestras and on board ship and so on. He was an excellent saxophone player. Well, he agreed to give me some lessons. So presently,